Chapter 9. His tale was that at 7 bells, in the forenoon watch, he had all hands mustered on the quarter deck, and told them they had better go down to say goodbye to the captain. Those words, as if grudged to an intruding personage, were enough for me to evoke vividly that strange ceremony. The barefooted, bare-headed seamen crowding shyly into that cabin, a small mob pressed against that sideboard, uncomfortable rather than moved, shirts open on sunburned chests, weather-beaten faces, and all staring at the dying man with the same grave and expectant expression. Was he conscious? I asked. He didn't speak, but he moved his eyes to look at them, said the mate. After waiting a moment, Mr. Burns motioned the crew to leave the cabin, but he detained the two eldest men to stay with the captain while he went on deck with his sextant to ache the sun. It was getting toward noon, and he was anxious to obtain a good observation for latitude. When he returned below to put his sextant away, he found that the two men had retreated out into the lobby. Through the open door he had a view of the captain lying easy against the pillows. He had asked away while Mr. Burns was taking this observation. As near noon as possible. He had hardly changed his position. Mr. Burns sighed, glanced at me inquisitively, as much as to say, "Aren't you going yet?" and then turned his thoughts from his new captain back to the old, who, being dead, had no authority, was not in anybody's way, and was much easier to deal with. Mr. Burns dealt with him at some length. He was a peculiar man of 65, about iron gray, hard-faced, obstinate, and uncommunicative. He used to keep the ship loafing at sea for inscrutable reasons. Would come on deck at night sometimes, take some sail off her, God only knows why or wherefore, then go below, shut himself up in his cabin, and play on the violin for hours till daybreak perhaps. In fact, he spent most of his time day or night playing the violin. That was when the fit took him. Very loud too. It came to this, that Mr. Burns mustered his courage one day, and remonstrated earnestly with the captain. Neither he nor the second mate could get a wink of sleep in their watches below for the noise. And how could they be expected to keep awake while on duty? He pleaded. The answer of that stern man was that, if he and the second mate didn't like the noise, they were welcome to pack up their traps and walk over the side. When this alternative was offered, the ship happened to be 600 miles from the nearest land. Mr. Burns at this point looked at me with an air of curiosity. I began to think that my predecessor was a remarkably peculiar old man. But I had to hear stranger things yet. It came out that this stern, grim, wind-tanned, rough, sea-salted, taciturn sailor of 65 was not only an artist, but a lover as well. In Haiphong, when they got there after a course of most unprofitable peregrinations during which the ship was nearly lost twice, he got himself, in Mr. Burns' own words, mixed up with some woman. Mr. Burns had had no personal knowledge of that affair, but positive evidence of it existed in the shape of a photograph taken in Haiphong. Mr. Burns found it in one of the drawers, in the captain's room. In due course I too, saw that amazing human document. I even threw it overboard later. There he sat, with his hands reposing on his knees, bald, squat, gray, bristly, recalling a wild boar somehow, and by his side, towered an awful mature, white female with rapacious nostrils and a cheaply ill-omened stare in her enormous eyes. She was disguised in some semi-oriental, vulgar, fancy costume. She resembled a low-class medium, or one of those women who tell fortunes by cards for half a crown. And yet she was striking. A professional sorceress from the slums. It was incomprehensible. There was something awful in the thought that she was the last reflection of the world of passion for the fierce soul which seemed to look at one out of the sardonically savage face of that old seaman. However, I noticed that she was holding some musical instrument, guitar or mandoline, in her hand. Perhaps that was the secret of her sortilege. for Mr. Burns, that photograph explained why the unloaded ship had kept sweltering at anchor for 3 weeks in a pestilential hot harbor without air. They lay there and gasped. The captain, appearing now and then on short visits, mumbled to Mr. Burns unlikely tales about some letters he was waiting for. Suddenly, after vanishing for a week, he came on board in the middle of the night, and took the ship out to sea with the first break of dawn. Daylight showed him looking wild and ill. The mere getting clear of the land took 2 days, and somehow or other they bumped slightly on a reef. However, no leak developed, and the captain, growling, "Oh matter," informed Mr. Burns that he had made up his mind to take the ship to Hong Kong and dry dock her there. At this Mr. Burns was plunged into despair. For indeed, to beat up to Hong Kong against a fierce monsoon, with a ship not sufficiently ballasted, and with her supply of water not completed, was an insane project. But the captain growled peremptorily, "Stick her at it," and Mr. Burns, dismayed and enraged, stuck her at it, and kept her at it, blowing away sails, straining the spars, exhausting the crew nearly maddened by the absolute conviction that the attempt was impossible, and was bound to end in some catastrophe. Meantime the captain, shut up in his cabin and wedged in a corner of his settee against the crazy bounding of the ship, played the violin, or, at any rate, made continuous noise on it. When he appeared on deck he would not speak, and not always answer when spoken to. It was obvious that he was ill in some mysterious manner, and beginning to break up. As the days went by the sounds of the violin became less and less loud, till at last only a feeble scratching would meet Mr. Burns' ear as he stood in the saloon listening outside the door of the captain's stateroom. One afternoon in perfect desperation he burst into that room and made such a scene, tearing his hair and shouting such horrid imprecations, that he cowed the contemptuous spirit of the sick man. The water tanks were low, they had not gained 50 miles in a fortnight. She would never reach Hong Kong. It was like fighting desperately toward District Iron for the ship and the men. This was evident without argument. Mr. Burns, losing all restraint, put his face close to his captain's and fairly yelled, "Colin, you, sir, are going out of the world. But I can't wait till you are dead, before I put the helm up. You must do it yourself. You must do it now." The man on the couch snarled in contempt. "So I am going out of the world, am I?" "Yes, sir, you haven't many days left in it," said Mr. Burns, calming down. "Ne can see it by your face." "My face, eh? Well, put up the helm, and be damned to you." Burns flew on deck, got the ship before the wind, then came down again composed, but resolute. "I've shaped a course for Pulo Condor, sir," he said. "Can we make it, if you are still with us, you'll tell me in 2 what port you wish me to take the ship, and I'll do it." The old man gave him a look of savage spite, and said those atrocious words in deadly, slow tones. "If I had my wish, neither the ship nor any of you would ever reach a port. And I hope you won't." Mr. Burns was profoundly shocked. I believe he was positively frightened at the time. It seems, however, that he managed to produce such an effective laugh, that it was the old man's turn to be frightened. He shrank within himself, and turned his back on him. "And his head was not gone then," Mr. Burns assured me excitedly. "He meant every word of it." Such was practically the late captain's last speech. No connected sentence passed his lips afterward. That night he used the last of his strength to throw his fiddle over the side. No one had actually seen him in the act, but after his death Mr. Burns couldn't find the thing anywhere. The empty case was very much in evidence, but the fiddle was clearly not in the ship. And where else could it have gone to but overboard? "Threw his violin overboard," I exclaimed. "He did," cried Mr. Burns excitedly. "And it's my belief he would have tried to take the ship down with him, if it had been in human power. He never meant her to see home again. He wouldn't write to his owners. He never wrote to his old wife. Either he wasn't going to. He had made up his mind to cut adrift from everything. That's what it was. He didn't care for business, or freights, or for making a passage or anything. He meant to have gone wandering about the world till he lost her with all hands. Mr. Burns looked like a man who had escaped great danger. For a little he would have exclaimed, "Colin, if it hadn't been for me." And the transparent innocence of his indignant eyes was underlined quaintly by the arrogant pair of mustaches which he proceeded to twist, and as if extend, horizontally. I might have smiled, if I had not been busy with my own sensations, which were not those of Mr. Burns. I was already the man in command. My sensations could not be like those of any other man on board. In that community I stood, like a king in his country, in a class all by myself. I mean an hereditary king, not a mere elected head of a state. I was brought there to rule by an agency as remote from the people, and as inscrutable almost to them as the grace of God. And like a member of a dynasty, feeling a semi-mystical bond with the dead, I was profoundly shocked by my immediate predecessor. That man had been in all essentials but his age just such another man as myself. Yet the end of his life was a complete act of treason, the betrayal of a tradition which seemed to me as imperative as any guide on earth could be. It appeared that even at sea a man could become the victim of evil spirits. I felt on my face the breath of unknown powers that shape our destinies. Not to let the silence last too long, I asked Mr. Burns if he had written to his captain's wife. He shook his head. He had written to nobody. In a moment he became somber. He never thought of writing. It took him all his time to watch incessantly the loading of the ship by a rascally Chinese stevedore. In this Mr. Burns gave me the first glimpse of the real chief mate's soul which dwelt uneasily in his body. He mused, then hastened on with gloomy force. Yes. The captain died, as near noon as Poe Sybil. I looked through his papers in the afternoon. I read the service over him at sunset, and then I stuck the ship's head north and brought her in here. I brought her in. He struck the table with his fist. She would hardly have come in by herself, I observed. But why didn't you make for Singapore instead? His eyes wavered. He nearest port, he muttered sullenly. I had framed the question in perfect innocence, but his answer, the difference in distance was insignificant, and his manner offered me a clue to the simple truth. He took the ship to a port, where he expected to be confirmed in his temporary command from lack of a qualified master to put over his head. Whereas Singapore, he surmised justly, would be full of qualified men. But his naive reasoning forgot to take into account the telegraph cable reposing on the bottom of the very gulf up which he had turned that ship which he imagined himself to have saved from destruction. Hence, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.